The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network. Brother Michael?
Yes.
Oh, we are on air, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that, Brother Scott. We have Michael Scott here of Equity Matters, and I've asked my colleague and friend Donna Brown to join me, who's a soldier in on the ground in the field here in Baltimore. And tonight, we wanted to have a conversation around healing. So first, I want to shout out Black Talk Radio and Race Treaty. And Robin Benton, as always, and Anaji Muid, who brought me into the fold and to the family. And we thought we would have a conversation on community healing, both at the individual level, and with respect to, the collective level, as well as sort of in between at the organizational level. We're coming up here, talking to you all from Baltimore. And we're coming up very shortly on the one year anniversary of the Freddie Gray uprising. And, it was very, poignant for me, to have a moment right in the middle of the uprising to get away and to go to America Healing, which the Kellogg Foundation has been putting on for a few years. It was my first time going. And it was really interesting because, I had not seen my own need for healing as poignantly as I did when I actually went. Because people kept saying, "Are you all right? You don't seem like you yourself." And I was like, "What are you talking about? I'm fine." And it wasn't until I spent a few days there in some healing circles and some conversations, listening to some good music, having some good food, some wine, some colleagues who've been doing this work in all over the country, to kind of reflect and see that we were all indeed traumatized. So when I came back home, I brought that message with me, checking in with other young brothers and sisters who were on the front lines as well, just checking in on how they were doing. And one guy in particular who I won't call his name out, but he was showing signs of Bell's palsy, and it looked to me like he'd had a stroke. And he's somebody that's well known locally and even nationally in some of the circles that we've all been in together. And so I kept after that young brother. How you doing, man? Are you making sure you take some time away? Cause I think what we're finding, and Don, I'd like to bring you in, is that a lot of times we get so caught up in this thing and we don't take a minute, to separate the forest from the trees. And so I wanted to talk about starting with the individual level of how you experienced the stress and trauma and need for healing that you witnessed of other individuals, including yourself in the uprising, and how you might have been intentional about supporting, mitigating that for yourself and for other people. And then we can also have a conversation around, what that looks like both at the collective level and at the organizational, both organizing and organizational level. So, with that, I'd like to invite you in the conversation. Don and I go way back to high school. We reconnected during the People's Institute's Undoing Racism, or Understanding and Undoing Racism and Community Organizing Workshop, which we took together and had opportunity to build. So Donna, what say you about, the need for healing personally and individually as you saw for not only yourself, but for folks in your community?
Mike, I think back to, and I can remember it. I'm at my mom's house right now, and I remember the night of the uprising, rushing here because the building across the street from her, which is John K. Hickman's church, Seven Baptists, they were building a new senior building across the street, which had ignited in flames, and the flames were so intense. They were at my mom's window, and so she called me frantically, and I ended up rushing over, here. And so being here and remembering, being in that spot where I was almost a year ago, thinking about what everything that was taking place, it's strange because I just remember being in the midst of it. I'm also a chaplain for the Baltimore City Police Department, and I'd gotten a call right after Freddie Gray's funeral, asking for all of the chaplains, to come to North Avenue, where things had started, and being out in the midst of it. And when you're in the throes of it, you really don't have time to think about it. You're just reacting and you're responding to what's taking place. You're ministering, you're fostering, you're helping, folks by, wherever needed and however needed. And in the space of affecting change, touching lives in the moment, you don't have time to think about you. You're just thinking about responding to, to the trauma, addressing it and helping. But I just remember the feeling. It was such an intensity that night. And the whole week afterward, I remember driving down, Glens Falls Parkway and seeing all of the military vehicles, littered through my neighborhood, and feeling this sullen feeling, because that presence brought such a hard feeling, and just thinking about our kids, waking up to this and going throughout their daily lives, in the midst of this, and really thinking about him. For me, it was traumatic, because every day that I drove through that neighborhood and I'm witnessing this, I'm looking at, the trucks on the back side of the mall, and just how sinister everything just seemed, at that moment. This is not the environment that you want to wake up to every day. This is not what you want to live, So I'm thinking, not just in the moment, I'm thinking, long foresight with, thinking about what the potential is, and thinking about all of the things that we endure in our communities, even without that. And then this added to it. It was strange. It was emotional. I remember driving down the street one day and just bursting into tears, because mm-hmm. as you're working through it, you're affected by it, and you don't have time to process it because you're just working through it. And I think that's, for a lot of folks, at the time, you're just getting up every day and people are responding to it. So yes, there was a lot of activism and a lot of organizing that was birthed out of it, which is wonderful. But the reason why all of that came to fore was because there was a sense of this lull over the city prior to that people had long been dealing with, and you never really think about it until something, hits, and the uprising was the thing that really brought it to fore for a lot of people.
So there's a lot that you just shared that I think we can unpack, and I definitely want to put a flag in a couple of those things as we continue down the conversation of the individual. But one of them that you really raised for me, a couple, the work that we do around social determinants and health, now everybody wants to talk about it, right? Just like everybody wants to talk about equity, like they say in the Black church historically. Everybody yeah. talking about heaven ain't going there. Everybody talking about equity ain't doing it. or racial equity or racial healing, any of that stuff. But one of the things that's a key concept for us, in this health thing is this, $10 word, allostatic load, that's A-L-O static, like static cling. And, you know, I know you know that word, but I was sharing for our listening audience, but, you know, that word is a fancy word for the tipping point of stress, right? And so my grandmother used to say, boy, you're getting on my last nerves. Well, who knew she was a neuroscientist? Apparently there is a last tipping point stress of nerves. And once you've reached it or gone beyond it, you are chronically stressed. And what I want to unpack later a little bit as we talk about larger implications for community, is also the historic thing that you said is that, you know, we've been dealing with this for a long time. And many of us have said, you know, that the Freddie Gray uprising was so much larger than that one, unnecessarily lost life, as tragic as that was and unnecessary it was, that it was really a reflection of a longer set of traumas that had just bubbled over. And
I called it the aftermath. And, you know, everybody called it the uprising. I really called it the aftermath because this was the aftermath of years of dealing with things, years of struggling through community, you know, through issues in our communities, years of fighting through, you know, this discourse of attempting to affect change in our city, and years of witnessing people endure and not witnessing, but experiencing it, you know, as well myself, raising my own children in the city and the fears that I had, you know, as a mother, raising a son and a daughter, attempting to shelter and protect your kids from something that you really can't protect them from, you know. So it was really, to me, it was an aftermath. This is, you know, the wrath of years of distress that people had been enduring in the city.
So we'll definitely come back, because I think, you know, when you think of this notion of chronic stress, and so the latest science is talking about how, you know, that stress can be so acute, so long impacting, that can actually start to, well, we know it affects your chemicals in your body, your changes, your genetics, your epigenetics, as they call it, epidemiological genetics. But it can actually, you know, start to shift the genes and the DNA. They're saying that there's something to traumatic stress. And, you know, the psychologists and great thinker Joy DeGruy talks about post-traumatic slave syndrome. And of course, we just lost Francis Welty, who had, you know, work on the, psychological effects of this stuff. And so, you know, I think it's important to raise that connection that, you know, once you have these, you know, chronic worries, that it can start to affect your not only your health, but your DNA and that of your children's health. And so what you're saying is true. The other thing, though,
go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, you know, you think, I remember when I had my son, and I was in my eighth month before I told my mom, you know, that I was pregnant. I was single. Not married, so going through all of the stigma of that and the fear of telling her. And she asked me, why did I wait so long before I told her? Because I didn't show. And I told her, I said, you know, I didn't, it was already enough for me to go through without, you know, enduring pregnancy under the circumstances. And then the fear of the disappointment, what her reaction would be. And she said, I wouldn't have brought you that kind of stress, you know, during your pregnancy, especially, she said, because everything that you endure in spirit, your child bears as well. And so I thought about, you know, with that, yes, when I listened to Dr. Joy DeGruy talk about post-traumatic slave syndrome, and yes, the effects of that fear, you know, that was in the, that's in the mother, and how that transfers to the child before birth, you know. So we endure that, and we continue to endure that in our communities, because you're living through this kind of distress. And
think
about the burden of the mother and all of her fears, all of her concerns, all of her worries. And even though it is almost subconscious, because we're just fighting through it, because it's the norm, it's the standard, but you still, the conscious burdens. And so your child is born with that distress, because we transfer it. And so we transfer it not just in birth, but as they grow. All of the things that we rear our children in, all of the worries, the fears, that's what we raise our kids in. All of the don't do this and don't go here and don't do there and be back before. And the reason why you do all of those things is because of the fear.
Yeah, there's a great new film out, a documentary in the vein of the same folks that the California Newsreel documentarians, I guess is the word, that did Race, the Power of an Illusion, which to my thinking is still one of the most important films done, three-part series on deconstructing race or the construction of race. And all of its, you know, historical context and science and all of its social impact from the beginning
to up
to now. Yeah. And then they also did, Unnatural Causes is Inequality Making Us Sick, which was the first approach around, you know, social determinants and bringing that to the masses. Well, they've got a new one out called Raising America, which is all about the, dramatic effects that stress that you just described has. On fetus and in utero. So you're talking, you know, literally from the womb to you know, talking about the cradle to college or the, you know, school to college, prison pipeline. But really the stuff starts in utero with the stress and that allostatic load, and it can be passed on to children. So this documentary, I encourage folks to see and screen in their communities to talk about and to activate interest around, you know, action and organizing. So I mean, I think that's well documented at the individual level. I think we have to also start talking about what does it mean to have endured that for centuries, and how do we have to, you know, sort of start to shift that? Because I think the other thing that you recount in the story that happened during the uprising that was so poignant is that this has been going on for so long. And I mean, I remember seeing, or being in the room, rather, and I hope people see the tape, because there were many, many cameras up at Coppin. There was a listening session, and we had done two conflict transformation sessions with some world-class, you know, people that have been in some really tough places like Israel and Palestine and Rwanda and the Balkans and Somalia, where, you know, you know, there has been, you know, real death and destruction and mayhem and murder. And then, you know, coming to Baltimore, trying to transform the conflict that we sensed brewing. You know, about a week or two before, Freddie Gray died, there was a Department of Justice thing at Coppin State University.
Yeah, I remember.
HBCU. Do you remember that? And do you remember what the elders were screaming? Like, you know, we're going to arm ourselves. We're going to burn this MF, this Maryland farmer down. And, you know, it was stunning to me. And to think that elders had that level of prescience and just outrage. And I'll never forget that someone said, you know, this brutality is ongoing and we're going to have to protect ourselves. But, you know, and in fact, it happened this week while you were here. Go ask Freddie when he wakes up. Do you remember when they said that?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean,
you think about those elders that they've been carrying this for years. And so while we're working through and we're persevering and we're surviving in it, the issue is I'm still dealing with it, whether consciously or subconsciously, I'm still fighting that struggle. And so at the point of the uprising, you know, when everything is brought to the surface for everybody to deal with, I think about, you know, those elders. I think about my grandmother, who I'm grateful is honestly gone away from here, because I know what it cost for her in spirit when she talked about even what she endured and living through Jim Crow, what that cost her in spirit, and that she became, you know, nearly a recluse because she hated going out and being confronted by that level of racism. She refused to go to, you know, certain those stores. She refused to be patronized in any way, but just being rejected so fiercely that she refused to be a part of it. And that, I remember, I think we were in the mid-70s, and she was still getting milk and eggs, you know, delivered to her house every day, because she did everything that she could to avoid this. So our elders who have lived through this for cycles, and then being in the space, you know, of dealing with the aftermath of the uprising, yes, what that cost them in spirit.
Well, I'll tell you too, the other piece that you triggered for me was something that we really, I think, struggle with as a community and as activists. But the other individual aspect I like to consider is one that's not frequently talked about, right? Which is, you know, the language that we also share around gatekeeping and accountable gatekeeping. And so the fact that you're a chaplain from the police department really gives you insight as to, you know, how some of these officers are themselves traumatized and are dealing not only with the internalized racial oppression in terms of inferiority that all people of color have to struggle with, but now they're in another system that further dehumanizes not only them, but the people that they serve, and requires of them acts that, you know, can lead them to further compromise their humanity. And I'm really attuned to the fact that, you know, before we're going to get some of the collective healing, and we'll move into that part of the conversation shortly, you know, as well as the organizational work we need to do together and organizing work. But, you know, can you reflect on how you may have been witnessing or processing those within the system that are sworn to serve and protect us, be it police or other public goods, that themselves are traumatized and therefore may be re-traumatizing the very people that they're supposed to serve? I think you might be able to share some unique perspectives, and I wanted to make sure we lifted that up too, because that's something that we don't really consider, and so I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. You know, the whole system of racism. So it's the likelihood and the reality of functioning within something, and you just learn how to function within it. And what I've witnessed with a lot of our officers is just their survival in the system, because this is my livelihood. This is, you know, what makes provision for my life, my family. But also it gives me some sense of value. So, and the unique thing about the chaplaincy program, and the community policing program, it's mostly minority officers that are involved in it. Most of the white officers don't really engage, and because it's by choice, not by force. And so the handful, you know, that do, it's really just a handful of white officers that engage, but mostly black officers who are part of the whole chaplaincy program and that submit to it, as well as, the ones that do the whole community policing piece. But looking at them when I started working with them, really witnessing, because even there were officers that, after, you know, going through a few years and working with them and community and engagement piece, and then eventually becoming a chaplain, I, you know, believe that these are good officers. And so, yes, I would have been the one to have had the argument. Yes, they're good officers and they're bad officers. But nope, in the system, there are no good officers, because really even the good officers can't do anything about the bad officers. So I just become complacent and compliant for the sake of my own survival in it. But a lot of them don't even recognize exactly what it is that they're dealing with. They're in it, and I've learned that I've had to condition myself to just maintain in it. And I recognize some things that are wrong with it, but I've just learned how, you know, to survive in it. And that's the whole system of racism. You know, it's, go ahead.
No, keep going. Mm-mm.
it's this subconscious, you know, things that you're constantly dealing with. And I remember when we talked, when we were in the undoing racism class, that, you know, the fight through, is it or is it not, you know, when you're at that place when you're experiencing something, but you can't really put your finger on it. And you, I know it's racism, but I can't, I don't have the means to identify it, and it's not overt, so I can't necessarily call it out for what it is. And that's what a lot of the officers are dealing with. It's that, well, go ahead.
The Bigfoot, right? That thing that we can't see, but there's a footprint. I think
it's there. It's there, but I can't, it's not obvious. It is, but it isn't. And so I've witnessed the officers fighting, you know, and that's where it just becomes just about their survival. So I just learned that this is the air that I'm breathing. This is the space that I'm forced to function in. And I just learned how to maintain in it.
Well, and I think you also raised another point for me, because I think a lot of our younger folks struggle with it even more, some of them having grown up in the age of Obama, really having believed the hype of a colorblind society or whatever nonsense that they might have imbibed. And so they don't not only have the language for it, they were, sort of hoodwinked or trained or led to believe that it doesn't exist. And so they're doubly challenging. And so, you know, having to deal with that. And, you know, it's interesting to have seen that dynamic play out in Baltimore, because what most folks don't realize is, you know, we've worked, with a number of committees, including the Latinos, to have a conversation with the then Commissioner Batts around racism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've worked over a year kind of talking with him, right? You remember that. And he came out publicly well before the uprising, a good month and a half or two.
I didn't remember.
And he was on the front page of the local paper, The Sun. He was on NPR. So he made national headlines when he said that Baltimore had a racism problem, that it was like 1950s level, racism here, and no one would talk about it. And the FOP, I will never forget, the president, I forget his name, of FOP, wore his Irish green tie. He might as well have thrown up a blood or Crip sign, a gang sign.
Honestly.
And said, oh, is that right? Is that how you feel about that? Well, check this out. And I remember between that time and Freddie, you know, and the aftermath of the uprising, you know, the police were cracking heads. And I think that the, black and Latino officers and people, officers of color may have been, to show their loyalty to the thin blue, to that blue line, may have been cracking heads harder, if you will.
But they're forced to because I gotta maintain in this system. First of all, I've already been conditioned, you know, on how to survive in this, because I'm dealing with that, you know, subversive thing that I know that it's there, but I can't speak to it. So I just learned how to maintain in it. And so as a result of what happened, you know, during that time, they've recognized, in order for me to maintain in this, I got to respond. I got to act accordingly. And so you're seeing all of a sudden these black officers and yes, Latino officers becoming like worse, doing worse than a lot of those other officers who were really doing the dirt out there. You know,
I hope when they get pulled over, it's not a brother pulling me over, or, you know, because
seriously,
they don't have to. Prove
that was a consolation.
Right. So that's really interesting and something that's nuanced that I don't think most of us are appalled and doing some kind of activist work. Everybody, grandmamas, everybody doing something about what we see, because we just see, it's not that it's more of it, we're just seeing more of it and more stuff is explicit. But I think we rarely talk about that other side. And I think it's important to lift when we talk about healing, because it's a vicious cycle that's being perpetuated, even by people of color. And I don't think it often, you know, gets examined. But the other thing, though, that this conversation has raised is, it's not just the young people who've been told that there's no such thing as racism and they're struggling to identify, you know, Bigfoot, whether it really exists, even though there's the footprint and they feel it, you know, kicking their behind. The other piece is really around, you know, how all other systems, right? Like, so that could be said for just about any other institution that's supposed to be serving people, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I worked, within, over the, you know, prior to starting the work that I'm doing, we've been doing through the years, working in some nonprofit organizations and a nonprofit, national nonprofit foundation, and seeing how that plays out, that people, you know, within it, how racist those organizations were, but people didn't see it because I'm able to, you know, do this work, or I'm able to allow to function in certain positions. I'm able to, you know, reach certain audiences. That's enough for me to say that, it's to delude yourself and believing that, yeah, we're in a post-racial,
right,
situation or, but it's really not. And recognizing even within those who believe that they had some sense of empowerment, how limited they really were. But they were content with what they had, and not recognizing, I don't have the ability in my position to empower anybody else in this. And to to deny that to yourself. If I watched it, if I worked in it and I watched it, you have to put yourself in a place of denial, because if it's not your intent to do it, that's the only way you get to stay in that place of denial. Because if I have any intent to pull anybody else up, to raise anybody else, or to really be effective in the work that I'm engaging in, and that ultimately there will be some transformative change, you know, as a result of the years of investment and the amount of investment, you know, financial investment in this work, and really not able to at any given point recognize some critical point of change. I had these debates, you know, with folks, you know, who were in it, who I guess were allowed to delude themselves because they were having conversations with people on certain levels, but then you're not engaging with the people who are really affected by it. So you can take data and statistics and twist it and skew it and put out information that's really not true, because the people who are doing that work and engaging, who are hired to do this work, are not dealing with the people who are ultimately affected by it. They're dealing with their own, you know, cohorts in professional circles, but not really dealing with the people who are actually touched by it.
I think that's,
so you get to evade
really
yourself. Good.
I think that's really important to talk about, you know, some of the sort of parachute activism or activism addiction, you know, protest addiction that we've seen since Baltimore and Ferguson and other places, that there's a professional class of protester. And listen, I mean, I'm knocking folks who are committed to the cause, but I mean, that's one of the phenomena that we see, is that people, are dropping in and out and going to these things almost like, protest junkies. And, you know, we need some of those folks too, if they come with the right spirit and expertise. But a lot of folks are doing it for other reasons. And, you know, I think
well,
we
with
have
some
to
character
be-
and integrity, because, you know, some of the, these folks, unfortunately, are getting paid. And so they're believing in their own hype, because I'm getting paid to do this, not because I'm really speaking and advocating and fighting for something. And I'm able to my pay is the support that I'm able to garner in this. So I don't really have to amass anything, because somebody's paying me to do it. So, you know, and this is where those organizations, you know, get to get, you know, their stamp on the movements. And also get to have their hand in what's taking place. Why? Because they're paying the protesters.
No, I think that's really interesting, because when we look at citizens that become powerful because they choose to shift the context in which they act, you know, a lot of that is around people that are not paid. Right, that the small groups and the spontaneous work and the stuff that's sustainable is really not funded work, right? And there's an inherent challenge between, you know, that truth and those that are funded and how we balance that, because we don't want to starve out all that good activism because only a handful of gatekeepers are being paid and don't have that connection. And I think that terminology of gatekeeping is really critical because, you know, we talked about that today. I was with a group from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and some of them are really struggling. And I said, look, you know, you have to look at the word gatekeeper and which way does the gatekeeper face? It doesn't face permanently toward the institution, because if it does, they'll replace you like a doorknob. The gatekeeper faces outward. And the question I think that I raised for them was, well, can you toggle back and forth to let people in to change the institution and go back to your position and interface with that community, with integrity, with accountability in a way that allows you to stay in position, but also begin to shift and change the institution? Because if you just yell at the institution, they'll replace you, and you not having a job and not being conscious and able to support the institutional change isn't helping anybody any more than you sitting at that gate and never trying to elicit any change in the institution you're part of. And I think that's a really important conversation as we move to this part of the hour around, you know, how we think collectively around, you know, what is required to shift us. And I'm really struggling, you know, with, you know, both the business class and the middle class. I mean, we just have seen some statistics really recently. I think Ta-Nehisi just wrote a piece on, you know, the vast numbers of black folks that are falling out of the middle class. It's something like 60% will not stay into the class that they're born. So there's a downward mobility. But I think the more interesting question for me, as we talk about accountability and talk about accountable gatekeeping, we talk about, in the old idiom, you know, of whom much is expected, much, you know, of whom much is given, much is expected. What about the 40% that do stay or progress? What is the cost of that? And from a collective standpoint, I don't think that we're asking, you know, that question. I think it's a really, you know, people talk about, you know, in sort of an old century way, and even I think a misguided way, they talk about, you know, sellouts or Uncle Tom's. I think the more interesting character, which really is not even consistent with that book, but 12 Years a Slave for me, and when we screened that before it came out, the Mistress Shaw character that Allie Wolfson played, was a really interesting and complex character, because, you know, here's a woman who said, you know, I've been in the fields, you know, I've lived in the house, and now I'm on here on this veranda sipping tea, and I'm having to get in bed with the mask. That's a really complex conversation. And so I think, you know, instead of saying Uncle Tom's, if we lift up the Mistress Shaw complex and we talk about the black middle class, the black achievers, the transcendents, those of us who've been in business, and ask, you know, as we achieve individually, what is our, not that we're a monolith, but what is our collective thought and action? You know, not that we're all going to have the same one, but where is the Venn diagram of where we intersect and have accountability to a legacy of people and ancestors who made space for our success, whether they did it, you know, a generation or two before. Those people made space for our success, and those that are falling out of the middle class, there may be some correlation between those that are staying and progressing and their lack of accountability. I don't know what you think of that, but I think we should talk about it.
There is no accountability. There are those who laid the foreground for us to be able to prosper. And I think that a lot of us who have gotten into the positions that we're in now, I think about a woman that I worked with. She grew up in inner city Baltimore, and, you know, she was, well, her mother was a teacher, but she really did not work for most of her career. Her father, she was an at-home mom for most of her life. She went to teaching once her kids got older, and then, you know, retired early because I didn't have to, really, because my husband took care of me. But still, my husband worked for the railroad, you know, so, and he provided for the family, and he did everything in providing for them. But this is the person that still takes it in her mind, you know, that I worked for all of this. I earned all of this. No, some folks work and sacrifice, you know, for you. Your parents worked and made that sacrifice so that you could have this opportunity. And so there are a lot of us who have gotten selfish in this and self-centered, and that, yes, they're not thinking about the collective. They're not thinking about the necessity to be able to make a way for somebody else. So when I get into the position, how do I, you know, make way for, you know, to bring somebody else along? They become gatekeepers, but they're the gatekeepers looking out and locking other folks out versus looking for avenues to pull others in. And so I get frustrated with that, because when I'm looking at, you know, our young folks who are looking at, you know, I'm looking at the next generation. Who's bringing them along? Because we're going back to that old, the really old system of racism that, you know, is the face of discrimination is rearing its head overtly again. And so we're those who are in those positions that are able to bring us in, you know, looking for that opportunity. But they've gotten this sense of entitlement and this self-righteousness that I did this. Nope. Monkey, you ain't do this. It was plenty of folks for years before that laid the foreground for you to be able to be in the position that you're in, and for you not to recognize that is a disservice to them. But also it's a disservice to the next generation, for those who are looking for those opportunities. And we have to have a collective perspective. We can't afford to have an individualistic attitude.
Well, I think we all need some thoughtful healing practices on that, because I think it's very difficult to have some of those conversations. It's important though to do them, as challenging as it is, because I think that gets us into, you know, the piece around, you know, how do we practice, right? And I think, you know, we are not a monolith as a community. You know, there are many of us from many ranges and spectrums, from the far left to, well, I'm not even going to deal with that right. Mm-hmm. As insane as that is right now, it's even hard to process. But, you know, yeah. we're a spectrum of folks. And, you know, I don't know that we have developed accountability practices that allow us to humanize each other and develop loving, you know, sort of beloved communities, but also, you know, holding people accountable.
Struggle breeds that, Michael. So when you're in a place where I'm just fighting for survival, and when I come out of harsh conditions and I make it, then it becomes just about me and me maintaining, me surviving, versus me having a perspective, you know, to say, I need to be able to do this, not just for my own interest. I need to lay the ground. We had Unity Day at Western, and I didn't realize my Aunt Candy was a Westernite. And Western, for those who don't know, who are listening, is one of the oldest all-female public institutions in the country. But it is very esteemed, and we still carry the pride of being a part of that. And it was my aunt who helped me to get there. And I never knew this all of these years, because she's on my father's side, who I'm not that close to his family. So when I realized that, you know, today it was like, yeah, that it was somebody else who was thinking about the next, who didn't have a selfish perspective and say, you know, I got it and it was good enough for me to have it. No, she was looking at that. Yes, this is my opportunity to make way, you know, for somebody else. And I'm glad that she was thinking about me. But the value of what I got out of that experience was incredible. And I treasure it. But it was, yes, that somebody else had that perspective to say, I got to do it for, you know, for the next. I got to bring somebody else along. But it's oftentimes, you know, when folks come through that struggle, you know, they're only thinking about them and they don't think about the next. It becomes that sense of entitlement that, yeah, I worked hard for this. You absolutely did. Because we always do. We don't have the option not to. We don't get to skate by and get escorted through and folks just, you know, handed to you. And I watched that happen. I watched, you know, white folks who basically, you know, handed opportunities to folks. And I'm like, well, I've been here for a minute and she come in and she don't know nothing, but I got a teacher and she making more money than me. How does this happen? But they get to do that. We don't get to do that. So we can't afford to sit up there and just take it, you know, for granted and take it all for ourselves. I've worked for this. No, I've worked for this. Great. Work for somebody else to be able to have that opportunity.
I think that's really an important point to lift up, is that we need to embrace our ancestors, embrace the shoulders we stand on, you know, our history. We have to learn from our culture and our history. You know, the whole Sankofa thing, and, you know, this notion that I was listening about the Yorubu work that Dr. Mee is doing, but, you know, it reminded me of Dr. Ed Nichols and industrial organizational work that's been done, industrial organization work that he's done. You know, that when we've said it on the show before, you know, not a European sort of binary either or, but a very African both and. And, you know, there are, of course, many, Africa's a big continent, so there's many forms of what it means to be African. But, you know, I think, you know, looking back and doing that Sankofa thing, you know, making sure that we, you know, connect to how we practice unity in a different way. You know, some of these things are classic. And, you know, I want to, as we start to, you know, land this bird, you know, there's some questions that have been really powerful. And I remember we did a piece at the Urban League, a healing session, and they had, you know, right after, well, really in the midst of the uprising, right in the middle of curfew still, if you can believe we still had that. But, you know, there were massage tables, there were, you know, counselors, mental health counselors, there was all kinds of games for kids, there were people, you know, connecting the services, there was good music, there was food. And I had an opportunity to ask some questions. My buddy, a white brother, Peter Block, his latest piece on community belonging and structuring that and really asking some Socratic questions. And one of them, you know, I'll share a few just for the listening audience's consideration. And then they can, you know, perhaps ask others. But one of them I thought was really powerful was, what declaration of possibility can you make that has the power to transform the community and inspire you? Right? Mm-hmm. So that's a possibility conversation that I think has healing power when you ask it. Another one that I thought was really important though is, what is the story about the community or even the organization that you hear yourself most often telling, the one you're wedded to and maybe even take your identity from? And what would it look like, if you changed your mind, right? So what is the commitment? And this is really a dissent conversation. You know, what is the commitment or decision that you have made, that you've given that you've changed your mind about? You know, so what yes are you no longer willing to hold? What yes do you really no longer really mean? And I think these are healing questions because they require us to monitor where we've been and where we're going. Another one I want to share is, what is the cost to others for me to keep my commitments or to fail in my commitments? What is the promise I'm willing to make that constitutes a risk or a major shift for me? So I, you know, I think those are some really important conversations. You know, what gifts you hold in exile, is a gifts conversation. What promise am I postponing? Is yet another, a conversation or commitment. And so I think some of those things, as we think about healing and the work that needs to happen between organizations, because I don't know about you, but I have seen a lot of folks, both on an individual level and through the organizations that they represent, you know, going at it over some crumbs and over a little bit of shine, over a little bit of affirmation, over a little bit of, you know, 15 minutes in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's connected to how we started the conversation, right? That we have, mm-hmm. You know, we've endured so much, and now, you know, we get a minute and we don't know how to act. I don't know if you've seen any of that.
I have seen a whole lot of it, unfortunately. But so it goes to a point that I was driving at a little bit earlier, and keeping the integrity of what we do, and the integrity of those who are in it. And so when we talked about paid protesters, you know, how it kind of like dilutes the dialogue, and dilutes the motivation and mission. But at the same rate, you know, I'm thinking about, yes, to do this work, it really takes a heart of personal sacrifice. Mm. It takes a heart of conviction, and a heart of compassion to create a collective, that collectivism. You have to, that has to be your focus in it. And if it's not, it distracts from what we're ultimately trying to achieve. I think about what the power that the church really does have, if it does its work right. But we've gotten this thing that's really detracting from the church, and this prosperity thing, that we're forgetting about souls. We're forgetting about people. We're forgetting about struggle. We're forgetting about the distress. We're forgetting about the power that we have as a collective, as a church, to create that consciousness that should be, that we should be aspiring to. But we've gotten this individualistic thing in the church that's detracting from what our real goal should be. And so there's some power that's lost in that, because we're not doing our work. We're not doing what we ultimately should be doing. And we're not teaching what we should be teaching. Go ahead.
As we close, because I'm going to end with reading a few things to close out, because I know we're going to break a few minutes early. Whether that organization is your church, whether it's your nonprofits, your for-profit, social entrepreneur, whatever your organization is, you know, what is some kind of final closing thoughts around the healing that needs to be done, both at the individual, the collective, and in the operational level, whatever that, you know, whether it's the church, whether it's, you know, the African practice and ritual, whether it's, you know, your community organization, your sorority, whatever that organizational entity is, how do we synthesize, you know, and you know, in a collective, an intentional, non-monolithic, but intentional and collective way, our individual, our collective work, and our operationalized work in a way that's healing. Last thought, and then I'll close this out and hand it back to Scotty.
That's heavy. Let me see. So I think one, it's our teaching. It's driving our mission in all of the work that we do, and keeping that at the forefront. So it's maintaining that collective perspective and reinforcing that at every level. Because even in my individual pursuit, I still have to be conscious about the next. I still have to be conscious about how my individual position affects the next person, and what my ability is in that. So I can never be so self-serving that I forget, because I have an obligation in it. And so I think it is maintaining that collective perspective in every avenue that we work in. I worked for United Methodist Organization, and I remember at every staff meeting that the president would come, and he would, at the beginning of every meeting, he would thank everybody for their contribution, their efforts, their sacrifice. Even though everybody was getting a check, we wasn't doing this for free, but he still kept reinforcing to everybody's value and their work that they put into this, but still yet at the forefront, constantly lifting up the mission, the purpose, and the reason why we're all engaged in this in the first place. So we always have to keep our perspective about what is our ultimate mission and what we're doing. And so whether it's the church, whether it's the nonprofit, whether it's the organizing, whether it's the community activism, and whatever we're doing, we always have to keep drive that collective perspective, what our ultimate mission is, and keeping that at the forefront, but acknowledging each other in our work, honoring each other. It's about honor. but keeping that collective. And that way, I don't get so individualistic in my pursuit. I'm always connected and conscious and in my pursuit to reinforcing what that greater good is.
So I will say what Brother Olaji has lifted us for us today in a group we were working with the UN. Said, I am healing, you are healing, we are healing, our people are healing. And with that, mm-hmm. I'm going to close with some wisdom that my friend and neighbor, who was a liberation warrior and a panther one time, shared with me for my new year. Plan your work and work. This is a blueprint for freedom that she shared. Plan your work and work your plan. Love yourself. Never say never. Spend more time listening. Buy black. Get out of the red. Speak up when something is wrong. Be solution oriented. Take time to appreciate the simple things. Always examine both sides of the story. Remember your ancestors. Nothing in excess. Take responsibility for what is yours. Pray. Say no to anything that does not validate or support who you are or who you aspire to be. Respect your elders. Teach the children the truth. Take time to laugh. Enjoy life. Be an example setter. Think. Learn. Learn to forgive. Never forget. Have faith. Strive for excellence. Don't waste time. Never stop dreaming. Know you deserve success. Dream it. See it. Taste it. Touch it. Live it. Be your own best friend. Understand the power of the word. It can cut, crush, soothe, heal, and create. Count your blessings. Keep your word. Be in tune with your spirit. Choose your battles and fight to win the war. Stand tall. No one can ride your back unless it's bent. Give from the heart. Practice what you preach. Participate in the flow of love and prosperity. I would add abundance. Always journey toward enlightenment. Build on your strengths. Value relationships. Keep your head up. Seek purpose in all things. And get closer to God as you understand. Thank you for having us on again, family, at Black Talk Radio and Race Treaty. Filling in for Robin Benton, referred and brought into the family by Najee Reed. Donna Brown, it's been my pleasure to have you, my sister, on the show and to continue to
Thank
build
you.
As we do quietly, to do a little bit publicly. Scotty, I'm going to turn it back over to y'all, and you know, we'll see you next time. And y'all stay strong and take care.
Good
God
night.
Bless.
Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.